We present Ian Carmichael as Lord Peter Wimsey in Have His Carcass by Dorothy L. Sayers, adapted for radio by Alistair Beaton, with Mariah Aitken as Harriet Vane and Nigel Stock as Inspector Umpletee. Episode 4, The Snake in the Grass.
In the breakfast room of the Hotel Bellevue in Wilverton, Lord Peter Wimsey was lingering lovingly over his bacon and eggs, so as to leave no restless and unfulfilled moment in his morning. His absorption in the simple pleasures of breakfast was perhaps in some way compensation for the singular difficulty presented by a murder case in which the body had been washed out to sea and the two principal suspects had succeeded in disappearing without trace. Neither Julian Perkins nor Haviland Martin, both seen by Harriet near the scene of the crime, had been found since the day that Paul Alexis died. As for Lord Peter's success in tracing the origin of the razor found near the body, this achievement was outweighed by William Bright's cast iron alibi, an alibi that had not in any important respect been broken by the revelation that Bright's story was not the whole truth. The police still favoured the view that they were dealing with a case of suicide. But this view was about to be shaken by the discovery of a clear motive for the killing.
Ah, there you are, my lord. Found you at last.
All right, Inspector, it's a fair cop.
I just wanted to tell you the latest, my lord. I thought you'd like to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
It's given us something to think about, I don't mind telling you.
Has it? You look quite agitated. I expect you're out of practice.
Now, look here. You remember about Paul Alexis's banking account and the £300?
Sure thing.
Well, we've found out what he did with it.
What did he do with it? Well, go on. Don't keep me in such ghastly suspense.
He went and turned it into gold.
Into what?
300 gold sovereigns. 300 round golden Jimmy Old Goblins.
Well, Inspector, I always knew there were one or two oddities about this case, but I don't mind admitting that this beats me.
It's my opinion Alexis meant to get away, and he took the gold because it's the only form of money that'll pass everywhere and tell no tale.
True. Do you know, I think you're right, Inspector. But I say you realise this knocks the suicide theory on the head, all right?
It's beginning to look like it, my lord. We've got a much better motive for a murder than we had before.
Suppose Paul Alexis had hired old Pollock to meet him somewhere offshore with his boat and take him across to a yacht or something.
That's right. After all, it's possible that Alexis was wanting to leave the country.
Now, suppose in paying Pollock, Alexis had happened to show him the rest of the money. Couldn't Pollock have put him ashore and cut his throat for him and made away with the gold?
But why put him ashore? Wouldn't it have been easier to cut his throat aboard the boat and drop the body into the sea?
No, it wouldn't.
Huh?
Ever reckoned how much blood there was to the job? If Pollock had cut Alexis's throat on board, it would take a devil of a lot of swabbing to get the boat properly clean again.
That's quite true, my lord.
No, it is my belief the man was killed in the place where he was found. Murder or no murder? The question is, did the murderer come by sea, or did he come along the beach? What story, I wonder, does the beach have to tell?
Now, Harriet, let us list our discoveries so far. One boot, hobnailed and frightfully ancient.
One empty sardine can.
Two broken bottles. One sodden gold-flake packet.
Approximately half a Bible.
Do murderers read the Bible?
And one dead starfish.
Alas, poor fish.
Not very promising, is it?
Let's look further on. Over there, where it starts to get more shingly.
Oh, all right. Hello. Peter, look at this.
Aha, we are interested. Extremely interested.
It ought to mean good luck, anyway.
If you're holding it wrong way up, all the luck will drop out if you're not careful. And a black day it will be for somebody. Hand it over. It's a new shoe, and it hasn't been there very long. Perhaps a week, perhaps a little more. It belongs to a nice little cob, about 14 hams. Pretty little animal, fairly well bred. Rather given to kicking her shoes off. Pecks a little with the off fall.
Holmes, this is wonderful. How do you do it?
Perfectly simple, my dear Watson. The shoe hasn't been worn thin by the Emma on the Ard Eye Road, therefore it's reasonably new.
Can't you go on and tell the sex and colour while you're about it?
I'm afraid even I have my limitations, dear Watson.
Nonetheless, quite a pretty little piece of deduction. Peter, were you looking for a horseshoe?
No, I was expecting the horse. But the shoe is a piece of pure, gorgeous luck.
And observation. I found it.
You did, and I could kiss you for it. Let's make our way to Darley. I seem to recall that there were horses in the field next to where our Mr. Martin was camping. It'll be extremely interesting if one of them should be missing a shoe. Shall we go?
Look, up here, Peter. There's been a gap in the hedge. Recently mended by the look of it.
Indeed. With two new stakes and a bunch of dead thorns shoved in and secured with wire. Well, let's test my theory, shall we? Here, we'll scramble up this bank and have a look over the top.
Right.
Yes, there's Martin's camp. It's about just there. And one, two, three horses, no less.
Look how nicely those trees screen it from the road and the village.
Yes, a pleasant private spot for horse stealing, what? Hello, there's another gap a bit further down, which has been filled in a more workmanlike manner with posts and a rail. Let's go and have a look at that. Ah, yes, indeed. And what could be better? So, we climb the rail. And we are in the field. Permit me.
No, thank you. I can manage.
Yeah, good. Now then, which animal will you put your money on?
Not the black. He looks too big and heavy.
No, not the black, certainly. The jolly little bay cob rather takes my fancy. Come along, old girl. Here we are. Now then. There we are. There's a beautiful girl. Let's have a look at that hoof, shall we? Ah, look at it.
New shoe.
Better make sure they haven't made an all-round job of it. Come along. Easy does it, easy does it. Let's have a look at this one. Thank you. Now the back. Steady, steady, steady. There's a good girl. And the other one. And there we have it. Old shoes on 3 feet and new shoe on a 4. Corresponding exactly to the specimen picked up on the beach. The bay mare brings home the bacon, all right?
Now, we've checked up on this man Bright's story, and it seems to add up. We've established that he did come to Wolvercombe as and when he claims, and he's now living peacefully in a cheap room in town without showing the least sign of wanting to disappear.
Well, that sounds satisfactory. Have we established what his movements were on the day of Alexis's death?
Yes, my lord. He was taken on by an hairdresser in Seahampton, name of Littleton. Apart from an hour off for lunch between 1 and 2, Bright was working in the saloon all day. The proprietor then decided that his work wasn't good enough and he paid him off at the end of the day.
Well, it's perfectly clear that nothing short of a magic carpet could have transported Bright 40 miles to the Flatiron and back in order to commit a murder at 2 o'clock. Whatever part Bright plays in this tragedy, it is not that of first murderer.
We've also succeeded in having a little look at old Pollock's boat, my lord.
Have you, Bidjo? Mm-hmm. How did you manage that? I didn't think old Pollock was likely to be so cooperative.
Well, we did it surreptitious-like. I sent a young constable down to have a look around. He managed to examine old Pollock's boat pretty thoroughly, using a flashlight. No sign of bloodstains or anything there, my lord. Nor yet any sign of the boat having been scrubbed recent.
Let's consider our friend Haviland Martin again. He interests me rather more than Bright or Pollock.
Yes, my lord, I've been wondering about him since you told me about the horseshoe on the beach. I mean, if Martin really rode that mare from his camping site to the beach, does that mean he could have committed the murder?
Well, Umpletty, it all looks so good. But it won't work. You see the idea. Here's Martin. He arranges for Alexis to be at the Flatiron at 2 o'clock. I don't know how, but he works it somehow. At 1:30, he leaves the feathers, goes back to his campsite, gets the mare and rides along the shore.
Riding along the edge of the water so as to leave no mark.
Exactly. He tethers the mare to the ring that he's driven into the rock. He kills Alexis and rides back in a deuce of a hurry.
In crossing the rough pebbles below Pollock's cottage, the mare casts a shoe. When he gets back, he doesn't return the mare to the field, but he lets it run. Like that, it looks as though she broke out of the field on her own and will easily explain the gap in the hedge.
Also, if the horse gets found all blown and sweaty, it'll appear perfectly natural.
Right. He's back at 3 o'clock, in time to go round to the garage about his car. At some subsequent period, he burns the halter he has used, but leaves a small bit of it in the fire, which I found later. It's all so convincing. So neat. And yet it is all so wrong.
Why, my lord?
The time's too tight, for one thing. He left the inn at 1:30, we know that. After that, he had to get back to his campsite, catch the mare, and ride 4.5 miles. We can't very well allow him to do more than 8 miles an hour under the conditions, yet at 2 o'clock, Miss Vane hears the screams of Alexis being murdered.
Oh, it's exasperating. If we put the murder too early, Evelyn Martin wouldn't have had time to get there. And if we put it too late, he wouldn't have had time to get away. It's maddening.
One other point occurred to me, Inspector. Alexis's passport. I suppose we've already...
Oh, I trust your lordship doesn't imagine we would overlook such an obvious point. Yes, Alexis did have a passport, and what's more, he had it visited within the last month.
Had he now? Wherefore?
For France, to be sure.
Well, that offers some support for the theory that our young friend intended to flirt, what?
No, I don't mind admitting, my lord, that I'm coming round to your way of thinking. Here's a man with what I might call a purpose in view, and that purpose isn't suicide. And he had £300 in gold on him, and there's plenty as'd do murder for less than that. At least we're supposing he had it on him. We can't tell till we find the body.
Do you know, I feel inspired to make a prophecy. I think you'll find that Alexis was murdered, all right, but not for the sake of the money. I mean, not for the £300.
Why do you think that, my lord?
Because you haven't found the body.
You don't mean that somebody came and took the body away? What should they want to do that for?
What indeed? If my idea is the right one, that's the last thing they would want to do. They'd want the body found.
Eh? Why?
Because the murder was not committed for the £300 in gold.
But you said that was why the body wasn't found.
So it is.
Oh. Oh, let me see.
Try it in rhyme, Inspector. Why did they want the body found? They didn't want £300. They didn't want £300. That's why the body wasn't found.
Very good, my lord. Well, you're quite a poet. Yeah, I must write that down.
You have my permission to recite it at your next police concert. No fee.
You will have your joke, my lord. Now, how did it go?
Good afternoon, Smithy.
Good afternoon, sir. Fine day, sir.
It is indeed.
Turn the shoe round now, John.
Right. That's it. Yes, they'll get the hay in all right if this weather lasts. Not so much of this kind of work about as there used to be, I expect.
I recollect when there wasn't none of these multi-cars. Only the one Squire Goodrich had. What year would that be now? Mathakin year. So it were.
I can remember when my father kept 23 horses. Not counting the farm stock, of course.
That'd be a big place, sir.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was a big place. It was a treat for us kids to go down to the smithy and see him shod. I still know a good bit of work when I see one. I picked up this cast shoe on the beach. Mm. Off four. Nice little well-bred cob, about 14 hands, I shouldn't wonder. Kicks her shoes off and pecks a bit on this foot. Is that right?
That's right enough. A bay cob. That belongs to Mr. Newcomb. I should know it.
Your work?
Certain, sure.
Yes, our work, to be sure.
Not been lying about very long, either.
No. What day were it that Mr. Newcomb found the mare loose, Judd?
Friday it were. That's when it were. Friday morning.
To be sure, so it were. If you'd ask me, Mr. Newcomb did ought to have mended that gap in the hedge. Then there wouldn't have been no trouble, would there?
Right.
Well, I dare say that's true. Well, I'm most grateful to you. Afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir.
Afternoon.
Right, Really, Harriet, every character seems more suspicious than the last.
What I'd like to know most of all is what became of Perkins.
Yes, I wish the police would get onto him. Let's think, what do we know about him?
Personal characteristics. Small, weakish, round-shouldered, walked with a limp, dressed as a hiker. Appeared to be of timid disposition.
Met Harriet Vane on road at 4:15, about 1.5 miles from the Flatiron and 3 miles from Darley. Said he'd walked from Wilwickham.
On hearing about the body, turned back and accompanied me, ostensibly to protect me. But was about as useful as a raincoat under machine gun fire.
Disappeared mysteriously while Harriet Vane was telephoning the police about the body. Is then known to have taken car to Wilwickham Station and is now undiscoverable. I really believe I've never known a case so damnably confusing. Perkins, who has no alibi, disappears. Evelyn Martin, who does have an alibi, also disappears. And William Bright, having at first disappeared, now reappears with a cock-and-bull story about the state of the tides and an alibi that is as cast iron as the horseshoe we found on the beach. Too many alibis, Harriet. Too many alibis and too many suspects.
Peter, have you ever considered this?
What?
Harriet Vane, murder suspect.
Oh, really?
No, listen. Personal characteristics. Once tried for the murder of her lover and acquitted by the skin of her teeth. Says she found Alexis dead at 2:10, but can bring no evidence to prove that she did not see him alive. Took 3 hours to walk 4.5 miles to inform the police. Is the sole witness to the finding of the razor, the time of the death, and the conditions at the Flatiron. Was immediately suspected by Perkins and is probably still suspected by the police.
Nonsense, Harriet. I really...
Who have been searching her room.
Have they, Bedrove?
Yes. Don't look like that. They couldn't very well do anything else, could they?
I'll have something to say to Umpleton.
No, you can spare me that.
But it's absurd.
It is not. Do you think I'm witless? Do you think I don't know why you came galloping down here at 5 minutes' notice? Of course, it's very nice of you, and I ought to be grateful, but do you think I like it? You thought I was pretty brazen, I expect, when you found me getting publicity out of the thing. So I was. There's no choice for a person like me to be anything but brazen. I can't hide my name. It's what I live by. If I did hide it, that would only be another suspicious circumstance, wouldn't it? But do you think it makes matters any more agreeable to know that it is only the patronage of Lord Peter Wimsey that prevent men like Umpleby from being openly hostile?
I've been afraid of this.
Then why did you come?
So that you might not have to send for me.
Oh. Now, of course, everybody will say, look what he's doing for that woman. Isn't it marvellous of him? I suppose every man thinks he's only to go on being superior, and any woman will come tumbling into his arms. It's disgusting.
Thank you. I may be everything you say. Patronising, interfering, conceited, intolerable, and all the rest of it. But do give me credit for a little intelligence. Do you think I don't know all that? Do you think it's pleasant for any man who feels about a woman as I do about you to have to fight his way along under this detestable burden of gratitude? Damn it, do you think I don't know perfectly well that I'd have a better chance if I was deaf, blind, maimed, starving, drunk, or dissolute, so that you could have the fun of being magnanimous? Why do you think I treat my own sincerest feelings like something out of a comic opera if it isn't to save myself the bitter humiliation of seeing you try not to be utterly nauseated by them?
Oh, don't talk like that.
I wouldn't if you didn't force me to. And you might have the justice to remember that you can hurt me a damn sight more than I can possibly hurt you.
I know I'm being horribly ungrateful.
Grateful? Good God, am I never to get away from the bleat of that filthy adjective? I don't want gratitude. I don't want kindness. I don't want sentimentality. I don't even want love. I could make you give me that, of a sort. I want common honesty.
Do you? But that's what I've always wanted. I don't think it's to be got.
All right. I can respect that. Only you have got to play the game. Don't force an emotional situation and then blame me for it.
But I don't want any situation. I want to be left in peace.
But you're not a peaceful person.
Perhaps not, but all this is so dreary and exhausting.
Call me anything you like, but not dreary. Great Scott, have I been boring you interminably for 18 months on end? I know you once said that if anybody ever married me, it would be for the sake of hearing me piffle on. But I expect that kind of thing palls after a bit. I'm babbling, I know I'm babbling. What on earth am I to do about it?
Oh, it's not fair. You always make me laugh. I can't fight. I'm so tired. You don't seem to know what being tired is. Stop. Let go. I won't be bullied, Peter. I won't be bullied. And now, if you'll excuse me, I must make myself ready for an appointment.
I am crazed with jealousy. Who is the fortunate man?
Henry Weldon.
Henry Weldon?
Yes, he's invited me out in his car for a picnic, and I accepted.
Why ever did you do that?
Because the man believes he has a way with the ladies. I intend to prove him wrong, and at the same time see what information I may be able to extract from him.
Your dedication to this case, Harriet, is overwhelming.
Damn cows! Get out of the way! Go on!
I say, Mr. Weldon, I'm afraid this speed makes me rather nervous.
What's that? No need to be nervous. No point in these damn machines if you don't make a move. Not like a horse. No life in them. Only useful for getting from one place to another. You don't catch me motoring for pleasure. I like fresh air. Used to breed G's once. The bottom's dropped out of the market. Damn shame.
I quite agree. I'm very fond of horses myself. I think life on a farm must be wonderful.
All right, if you don't have to make it pay.
I suppose it is rather hard nowadays.
Damned hard. Not that I have a lot to grumble at as things go.
No, I'm glad of that. I mean, it's nice for you to be able to leave your work and come down here. I suppose a really well-managed farm runs itself, so to speak.
Well, as a matter of fact, Miss Vane, it's a beastly nuisance coming down here. What can one do? Couldn't leave my mother all by herself in this hole.
No, of course not. I think it's splendid of you to come and stand by her. And besides, well, I mean, it makes such a difference to have somebody really nice to talk to.
Jolly of you to say that.
I mean, it must make all the difference to your mother.
Not to you, eh? Dukes and lords are good enough for you.
Oh, if you mean Lord Peter, he's all right, of course, but he's a little... you know what I mean.
La-di-da. What's he want to wear that silly thing in his eye for?
That's just what I feel. It isn't manly, is it?
Not of affected nonsense. Take that fellow away from his valet and his car and his evening togs, and where'd he be? Thinks he can ride because he's potted round with a fashionable hunt, trampling down people's crops and leaving gates open. Oh, I don't want to be rude to a friend of yours. I say, what's he after down here?
Well, he says he's interested in this crime or whatever it is.
But you know better, eh? Listen, Miss Vane, I wish you'd do something for me, eh?
Of course, I'll do anything I could.
That's nice of you. Do persuade this Whimsy fella to drop it.
I don't know if I shall be able to persuade him. I'll do my best. But he doesn't like taking advice. You know what men are.
I bet you know all right. I don't suppose there's much you don't know, by Jove.
Don't drive with one hand like that. Suppose anything came along suddenly.
That's all right. I'll look after you, don't you worry. And you look after me, eh? Alliance. Defensive and offensive. Just between you and me, eh?
Oh, rather.
That's fine. And when all this stupid business is over, you must come and look Mother and me up. She's taken a great fancy to you. Get her to bring you along to my place. You'd like it. What about it?
That would be lovely. One gets so tired of the kind of men one meets in London and the stuffy, restricted, literary kind of surroundings. I don't suppose you ever come to London, Mr. Weldon?
Not often. No, of course, I'd come and call on you like a shot. Some inducement, eh? Where do you live?
I've got a little flat in Bloomsbury.
All on your own?
Yes.
Isn't that a bit lonesome?
Well, of course, I have plenty of friends. And a woman who comes in for the day. I could give you tea if you cared to come along sometime to cheer me up.
That would be sweet of you. We can go and do a show together or something. Pretty, eh? I'll bring the picnic basket. Why don't we eat down by that stream over there? Looks all right to me, eh? What about a few more strawberries, eh? Look, there's some cream left, too.
No, no thank you, Mr. Weldon. I couldn't eat another thing.
Good, wasn't it, eh? You're a very attractive woman. You know that, Miss Vane?
You mustn't talk like that.
Mustn't I? Can't help it. There's something about you, you know that?
Mr. Weldon, please. No, don't do that.
Oh, damn it. You might let a fellow kiss you.
No, let go, do you hear? I said that... Oh!
What's the matter with you, eh?
I want to leave. Now.
What set you off like that?
It wasn't you. I saw a snake.
A snake? Where?
It's gone now. I think it was a viper.
I didn't see any snake. Don't know what you're so upset about.
I want to go back.
Oh, all right. Wait a bit till I collect the picnic things together. Funny way to behave, I must say.
Well, how did it all go? Hello, what's the matter?
Oh, Peter, thank heavens you're here.
Here, I say. Hold up, hold up. It's all right, you know. At least it is all right, isn't it? Hold on, let me close the door. Now then, my dear, what's happened? You're all of a doodah.
Peter, I believe I've been kissed by a murderer.
Have you? Well, it serves you right for letting anybody kiss you but me.
Well, he didn't actually kiss me. He only hugged me.
Now, settle down. Settle down and tell me who this low-down, bone-headed, bird-witted, dissipated murderer is, who can't even keep his mind on his murdering, but rushes about the countryside embracing and hugging females that don't belong to him.
Very well. Prepare for a shock. It was Haviland Martin.
Haviland Martin?
Haviland Martin.
You win. I am astonished. I am thunderstruck. Kindly explain yourself. I thought you were out this afternoon with Mr. Henry Weldon.
I was.
Am I to understand that Haviland Martin is a friend of Henry Weldon's?
No. Haviland Martin is Henry Weldon.
In that episode of Have His Carcass, the parts were played as follows. Lord Peter Wimsey, Ian Carmichael, Harriet Vane, Mariah Aitken, Inspector Umpletey, Nigel Stock, Henry Weldon, Warren Clark, Blacksmith, Ronald Herdman, Judd, Spencer Banks, narrator John Westbrook. Have His Carcass was adapted by Alistair Beaton from the book by Dorothy L. Sayers and was produced by Martin Fisher.